from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Taiwan should be held up as a model of successful and equitable economic development and peaceful democratization. That's according to East Asia expert and Davidson College professor Shelley Rigger. And she talks about it in her new book, Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. We'll talk to her next about the island nation and find out why she thinks the United States should continue to support Taiwan in its efforts to resist unification on China's terms. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Taiwan, or the Republic of China, is an island of 23 million, roughly the size of Denmark. Independent since 1950, the People's Republic regards the island nation as part of its sovereign territorial integrity and continues to claim its demand for eventual reunification, which it has made abundantly clear that it believes in have taking place if necessary by force. Taiwan presently is one of the world's top producers of computer technology and possesses the world's fourth largest financial reserves, but it remains diplomatically isolated with no seat in the United Nations and formal diplomatic relations with only two dozen countries. Shelley Rigger, professor of East Asian politics at Davidson College and a consultant for the U.S. government on East Asian national security issues, recently published a book called Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. She joins us for this morning's opening forum hour, and welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Well, I think that a lot of people probably don't realize what an economic powerhouse Taiwan is and all this information technology equipment that's coming here as well as to the mainland, and to what extent it's got free markets and to what extent it's democratized and peacefully democratized. But what kind of example to the world? I mean, you talk about it as if somehow it will be a shining beacon to places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Are they really aware even of what's going on in Taiwan?
Well, I don't know about Afghanistan and Iraq, although I think Taiwan has put a lot of effort and resources behind kind of marketing its experience globally. But I think it is an example more on the economic side almost than the political side, because one thing that people everywhere notice is who has money and who is in a position to make investments, to create employment, and so on. And Taiwan has been a very significant player, especially in Southeast Asia and South Asia on the investment side. In the past 20 years or so, a lot of their investment has gone into mainland China, but they also have a lot of action in Vietnam and other parts of East Asia. So, you know, I think they're getting noticed.
Well, fourth largest financial reserves. I mean, that in itself speaks volumes. When you think about American debt, you think about, of course, mainland China. But all of this money that is awash in Taiwan is really pretty extraordinary.
Well, and I think what people frequently don't realize is how much of what we buy that has made in China stamped on it was assembled in China. And certainly, you know, some very significant economic activity happens in China. But very often, the core components, the really high value added and technology pieces are not only designed and gotten ready for manufacturing in Taiwan, but they're actually manufactured there. So Taiwan makes things like motherboards, it makes computer chips, it makes the high end of the high tech industry. And then those components get shipped over to China where they're put together into the final product. And so it looks like it's coming from China, but in fact, a lot of that value is being captured in Taiwan. And typically, that kind of manufacturing is being done for an American or other foreign branded company. So it really is a kind of global network in which Taiwan plays a crucial middle position.
And an integral role. I mean, a lot of the dots do connect to Silicon Valley right here.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, the Taiwanese government for years has had a kind of full court press on those Taiwan-born engineers who are working in Silicon Valley, trying to get them to come back to Taiwan and do their magic there.
Well, I realize the economic importance is one of the reasons we wanted to have you on here to talk about Taiwan, but there is political importance as well in a kind of paradigm of a country that was under authoritarian regime and then became pretty democratic. Also a country that was rife with corruption and has done a lot to root that corruption out.
Yeah, that's, I think, in some ways, for a political scientist, which is my profession, the more interesting or perhaps the more heartwarming part of the story. You know, making money has costs always. Business and manufacturing have a very good upside, but they also have kind of a downside. But democratization, I think, is a lot of upside, not much downside, unless you don't like, you know, uncertainty in politics, in which case it just gives you heartburn. But Taiwan's democratization process, which began in some sense in the 1970s, but really accelerated through the 80s and then finished off in the 90s, was remarkable not only because it succeeded and has consolidated and is really persisting and I think durable, but also because it was accomplished without really any bloodshed. And sometimes when I say that to audiences of Taiwanese, someone will stand up and say, you know, what about Zheng Nanrong? What about Lin Yisheng's children? And my answer to that is the fact that we can all enumerate the martyrs of Taiwan's democracy tells us that it wasn't there wasn't a lot of bloodshed. There wasn't a lot of actual violent conflict between the authoritarian state and the forces of democratization. There was some, but compared even to South Korea, which is another, in my view, huge success story for democratization in Asia, even compared to South Korea, Taiwan managed to pull this off with very little instability or violence.
Talking to Professor Shelley Rigger, her book is Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. Shelley is for Percy Bysshe Shelley, by the way, we should mention. I'd like to get that little literary footnote in there. You're sort of really in some ways a cheerleader for Taiwan, aren't you?
Well, I guess so, because I think I need to be at this moment. For a long time, I think Taiwan had a lot of currency with American policymakers and many, especially in Congress, you know, there was a huge Taiwan lobby. And that, the reason for that evolved over time from in the immediate post-World War II era, when Taiwan became the kind of last bastion of non-communist rule in that part of Asia. And, you know, the U.S. was throwing resources at Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan to try to block the expansion of the communist
ideology. This is the Chiang Kai-shek era, right?
Right, in the Chiang Kai-shek era. And then you had sort of through the Cold War, a lot of American politicians who said, you know, even as we have to have some kind of rapprochement with mainland China, with the People's Republic of China, we're going to still have a special relationship with the nationalist regime, Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist regime there on Taiwan. Then as Taiwan became kind of less and less attractive to Americans, as the authoritarian qualities of the Taiwanese government became more evident and more widely recognized, Taiwan went in this democratic direction and again sort of replenished its goodwill and positive reputation in the West and especially in the U.S. But just in the last few years, as the PRC's power and influence have really taken off internationally, what I perceive is a decline in enthusiasm for Taiwan. And a lot of American policymakers, not so much in the Foreign Service or in, you know, in the State Department, but in the kind of policy community in Washington, I think a lot of people are just tired of this issue. They don't understand why Taiwan doesn't just kind of go away. And so this book is really aimed at reminding Americans and readers of the English language in other countries too, if they want to read it, reminding them why we still ought to pay attention to and care about Taiwan, not only because it's in our interest to do so, which I think in many ways it is, but also because it's the right thing to do.
It's one of these special relationships, one could argue, and it reaches a sort of a tipping point with the People's Republic getting more power. And one thinks, for example, of changes that have been going on in the Middle East, special relationship with Israel, let's say, and here's special relationship doing a lot for Taiwan's security, the way the United States has done for Israel's security, mm-hmm. and suddenly backing away from that because of a kind of tipping point and because of the fact that the People's Republic has become increasingly more and more powerful and we've become more and more indebted to them. But they still have their missiles, of course, aimed at Taiwan.
Right. And they like to say that, you know, the relationship between Taiwan and the mainland is fine and that, you know, the U.S. just needs to back off and there's no danger there. But I agree that as long as the missiles and the number of short range missiles aimed at Taiwan increases all the time, as long as, you know, there is an active and growing military threat to Taiwan, I don't think we can quite settle in and feel comfortable that this is not a situation that the U.S. needs to pay attention to.
Well, the U.S. has certainly been a strong ally of Taiwan for the most part in recent years. And now one has to look at this from yet another perspective, and that is Taiwanese culture is so distinct and so different. I mean, here is mainland China saying it's part of our sovereignty, it's part of our territorial integrity, like it says about Tibet. And yet the reality is, in many ways, Taiwan was much more strongly influenced by Japan, wasn't it?
And that is one of the things that I really try to bring out in the book, is that we can certainly think about how certain policies toward Taiwan might serve U.S. interests, might serve PRC interests. But I am also trying to encourage people to think about how Taiwan also exists as an end in itself and not merely as a means to other nations' ends or other states' ends. And I think that while unification, some kind of coming together under some kind of political framework between the People's Republic of China, or the Chinese mainland, and Taiwan is not impossible, and I would by no means oppose it if it were something that the two sides were able to work out.
Happened with Hong Kong.
Right. And if, you know, as long as it's a kind of mutual agreement, I have actually a pretty high level of confidence that in the future, flexible and creative people who are only young now or may not even be born yet can figure this thing out. But I think where the problem lies is with the idea that there might be some pressure or kind of compulsion or impatience to get this unification done before the two sides have had a chance to kind of grow together. Because as you say, they've been growing apart for a very long time. Taiwan became a colony of the Empire of Japan in 1895 and remained under the Japanese Empire until the end of World War II. So for the 50 years that China was learning its own nationalism and really inventing modern Chinese nationalism, the last decades of the Qing Dynasty and then the Xinhai Revolution 100 years ago in 1911, the war of resistance against Japanese aggression, which is how that World War II is known in China, and into the Chinese Civil War. I mean, the May 4th movement, all of these critical moments for the development of Chinese nationalism happened when Taiwanese were thinking of themselves as, you know, citizens or subjects of the Japanese emperor. And so Taiwan really missed the forging of this strong Chinese nationalism. Now,
Which gives it a distinct identity apart from China, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it does. And then Chiang Kai-shek came to Taiwan and tried to inculcate that Chinese nationalism there, and it never really took. So in the 1980s, when the Taiwanese government finally kind of trying to gave up trying to make Taiwan feel it, since then, Taiwan has kind of blossomed and grown into its own identity, which I would argue is an identity that is not only Taiwanese, but is also Chinese in very significant ways. About 98% of Taiwan people have Chinese ethnic background.
But disparate in languages and cultures.
And most of those families came to Taiwan in the 1600s. So, you know, we're talking about people who haven't been in the mainland for a very long time. So you have all these layers of history, layers of settlement, layers of migration, layers of invasion and occupation. And I think that process has created in Taiwan, as you say, a very distinct identity that cannot easily be enfolded into the kind of Chinese nationalism that the PRC government embraces so tightly.
And you make the case that Taiwan is, well, a very significant manufacturing asset to the United States.
Well, it's a manufacturing asset to the United States, and I think it's also in some ways a soft power asset to the United States. You know, we go into Afghanistan or Iraq even more and say we're going to fight our way to a democratic Iraq. And at the same time, and you know, I think there are a lot of people in the world who have a very cynical reaction to that, and perhaps with some good reason. But the U.S. can also point to Taiwan as a friendly country that has received an enormous amount of assistance from the U.S., both economic and military, political, to say there is the possibility of prosperity and democracy without these wrenching upheavals and violent episodes. So, you know, in some ways, I think the U.S. could do an even better job of leveraging that asset, that soft power asset, to say, you know, our goal is not to create chaos in your country, because not all of our allies or our friends that have democratized have had to go through that. And I think to the extent to which the U.S. separates itself from experiences like Taiwan's and to some extent even South Korea's, we appear more and more to rely solely on a military strategy for promoting our values in the world and lose the opportunity to remind other nations that, you know, that's not the only way we do it. We don't always do it at gunpoint. And that's not to say that the U.S. democratized Taiwan. Taiwan people democratized themselves. But the U.S. was a supportive friend through the process.
Our guest is Shelley Rigger. Again, her new book is Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. I'm going to open the phone lines now. There are many of you who may have some thoughts, certainly about reunification, and it is an ongoing controversy. That is the People's Republic of China believing that Taiwan is part of their sovereign territorial integrity. We also want to talk about just the fact that Taiwan is maybe indeed, as Shelley Rigger argues, a beacon to democracy and how much that really matters and how much Taiwan matters. The book title is Why Taiwan Matters, and there are many who perhaps are sloughing that off. It's a small island, size of Denmark, 23 million people is not small, but small in the grand scale of things, particularly in conjunction with the People's Republic. You may want to weigh in here, and if you have questions or comments, we certainly welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can call us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join us at 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or you can post a question or comment on our Facebook page. There's this Taipei 101, which you use as a kind of symbol, really, of the strength in some ways. And I mean, it's really quite something. Here's a beautiful island to begin with. You make that case. As I said, there's some cheerleading here and there's some bolstering of – but talk about Taipei 101, because it is as skyscrapers and as the World Trade Building was to the Arab population in terms of being a symbol, this is really a symbol for you of Taiwan.
I love Taipei 101. It was, for 6 years, the world's tallest building. Had to be, of course, overtaken by Burj Dubai, which I think will reign for longer than 6 years, as that is really a prodigious monster in terms of skyscraperage. But Taipei 101 is no slouch either. And I use it as a kind of symbol for Taiwan because it wasn't necessary to build the world's tallest building in Taipei. Taipei is a city, it's crowded, you know, but there are no buildings nearly that height. The next largest building is only half as high as Taipei 101. But I think the fact that the architects and investors decided to build this kind of prestige building is consistent with this sense of we want to be noticed. You know, we need to be seen, that Taiwan feels itself becoming invisible in the international community. And so, you know, they built this ginormous big tower, which is very lovely. It's a kind of, it's a glass sheathed tower. It's the glass is kind of greenish blue in color, and it stands up there looking great. But you just have to ask yourself, you know, wow, was that really necessary? There's plenty of room. You know, you could have built a third of that height at a much lower cost. And so to me, the building really says, we want to be seen. We want to be recognized. And the only way we know how to do that is to act in ways that are disproportionate, in the same way that our accomplishments are disproportionate. You know, such as a country the size of Denmark or the population the size of Ghana, to have the world's fourth largest foreign exchange reserves. You know, this is a little country that kind of punches way above its weight, and I feel like Taipei 101 shows that. But I would also mention a beautiful video that's on YouTube right now called "Where the Hell Is That Taiwan Guy?" which takes the same kind of mentality and puts it at a human scale. It's a young guy, kind of early 20s, from Taiwan, who is making videos of himself dancing in developing countries in the costume of the third prince, who is a Chinese sort of religious figure. And he puts on this huge costume and he goes to places like Egypt, Kenya, India, and does a little dance with local people. And he's put these videos on YouTube. But in the middle of the video where he's dancing in Kenya and Egypt, he explains his motivation. And he says something like, I was tired of Taiwan being bullied internationally. I wanted people to know about this beautiful country, this amazing people called Taiwan. And so that's why he's doing this. And I think it's the same kind of motivation on a very small and human scale that drove the construction of Taipei 101.
But of course, it continues to be Taiwan overshadowed by the People's Republic in so many ways. And the People's Republic vying for and insisting on eventual reunification, one has to wonder if I mean, now they have signed a trade pact, there's exchange of messages, there's been a thaw of some sort. But one has to wonder if part of the desire on the part of the mainland is because 50% of the exports from Taiwan go to mainland China, and what, about $150 billion is invested from Taiwan into mainland China. So, again, one thinks of Hong Kong as a paradigm here. The takeover of Hong Kong was very significant in terms of economically bolstering this growing and extraordinary fact of the People's Republic.
Right. The economic relationship is really ambiguous for the PRC because on the one hand, I think they would very much like to be able to use the economic ties and the, you know, very vibrant economic relationship between the two sides to promote unification, political unification. But on the other hand, they definitely don't want to, kill the goose that's laying all these golden eggs. So I think that the way this story is playing out is on the one hand, the PRC government tells itself and its own people, and I think with some merit, that all of this is helpful to unification. But on the other hand, they're in no big hurry.
Okay, we're going to go to break and we're going to come back and find out your thoughts. Have you been to Taiwan? You might want to join us and let us know about your impressions. What do you think about the ongoing controversy over reunification and just how much does Taiwan matter? When we return, we'll hear your thoughts. We're talking to Shelley Rigger. Her book is Why Taiwan Matters. Small Island, Global Powerhouse. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Shelley Rigger, professor of East Asian politics at Davidson's College, author of Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. She'll be at the World Affairs Council tonight at 6 p.m. And in many people's judgment, Taiwan matters because of security. And I'm talking, of course, about security in the American, excuse me, in the Asian Pacific region and the sense of historic and strategic ties that go back not only to the Cold War, of course, but before that and the commitment to Taiwan. We're getting responses here. Well, here's, for example, a comment on the web. Your guest seems to be a mouthpiece for Taiwan. Does she have any comments or thoughts on the disturbing labor rights violations by big companies in the country? Is she even aware of them?
Of course I'm aware of the fact that not so much within Taiwan, although there is, Taiwan companies have always historically been pretty tough on their workers. And frankly, many Taiwanese businesses are family businesses or small and medium-sized enterprises, and they can be some of the worst places to work, even if you're working for people, you're related to. So Taiwan doesn't have a fantastic labor record internally, but I think probably what the poster is referring to are the really large Taiwanese companies on the mainland. A couple years ago, there was a big kind of self-reflection or introspection about what exactly was going on in these Taiwanese factories when there was a series of suicides at the Foxconn factory in southern China, where they were manufacturing products for a major U.S. Electronics firm. And on the one hand, one could argue that this was a kind of tempest in a teapot, because the rate of suicides, sort of per capita rate of suicide in the Foxconn factory, was actually lower than in Chinese society in general.
But it got a lot of coverage.
It got a lot of coverage, and it should have gotten a lot of coverage, because you don't want to create conditions in a factory, in a business, where your people are that miserable. And, I think there's no question that Taiwanese companies went to mainland China because the labor was cheap, it was compliant, and the environmental regulations were nil. And I think the Chinese government and Taiwanese manufacturers probably share some responsibility for not doing a better job of protecting Chinese workers employed by Taiwanese firms. It's also true that American consumers, in demanding that everything get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper year after year after year, bear some responsibility for the conditions facing workers in the PRC, regardless of who owns the companies they work for.
Another listener says, I find it presumptuous to insinuate that the best technology originates in Taiwan and then is assembled in China. How could 20 million surpass more than a billion? Besides, how many mainland Chinese brains are pumping up Taiwan's universities and labs?
Actually, relatively few. The Taiwanese government has restricted the number of PRC people who can go to Taiwan. So PRC students are only now being admitted for the first time this year and next year in any kind of significant numbers to Taiwanese universities. It's certainly true that there's a lot of technological activity going on in the PRC, but the Taiwanese companies entered with a relationship with U.S. and other global high-tech brands that gave them a kind of leading position. And I think one of the major goals of the Chinese government's economic policies is to replace all kinds of foreign technologies and foreign investment with domestic technological development and investment. Their whole sort of indigenous innovation campaign is aimed at enabling that.
More and more autonomy.
Right. Clearly. But right now, so far, they still rely pretty heavily on these Taiwanese companies to be, again, the conduit between the marketed brand, Apple, Dell, whatever, and the manufacturing that's happening largely in the PRC.
Well, here's a sort of related question. How much profit does Taiwan make for the products manufactured in Taiwan with a Made in China label? Similarly, what is the profit margin for both China and Taiwan for products with a label Made in Taiwan?
The profit margins for the whole Chinese economy are incredibly, incredibly tight. In the last few years, I think now I'm not an economist of the PRC by any means, but I read a lot about the PRC economy and issues facing manufacturers in mainland China. And since the global recession, one of the hardest hit sectors in mainland China has been small and medium-sized manufacturers. That's a big chunk of China's private business sector. Those were the companies that were producing for export, and they've been really hurt by the contraction in global demand. The bigger companies, the state-owned companies in China and some of the larger foreign-invested companies have done a little better, but it is still the case that profit margins are very tight, and people have to work really hard, PRC people, Taiwan people, American people, to really squeeze a living out of the economy we're in today.
And let's bring our callers on. We go first to you, Kenneth. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. My name is Kenneth, and I was an attorney working in Taiwan in the mid to late 80s. And I had the good fortune to witness Taiwan developing itself into the democracy that your guest described. I think that they really did build their own democracy. And I remember watching, although I don't speak Chinese, I remember watching some of these debates where the KMT was on the outs, and I was somehow the spokesperson for democracy, being the only American there, and people would crowd around me as they departed the auditorium when the KMT speaker got up to speak. It was a very interesting time watching martial law come to an end. And I also got to see how values in Taiwan among people became compatible with law. It was explained to me that Chinese people, I'm not saying that it's true, but it was explained to me by many people when I lived there, that Chinese people held the family as the most important entity, and below that was friends, and way, way down beneath, because they knew I was a lawyer, they said there was the law. And if the law was compatible with the family and the friends, it was obeyed, and if it wasn't, then it was ignored. But I'm a big fan of Taiwan. I think some of the emails that you received are casting aspersions on Taiwan and are kind of cheap shots. You can find fault with any country if you look hard enough, but I wonder whether the people who sent those emails would want to work in Malaysia or Indonesia or even South Korea.
Kenneth, I thank you for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. We'll go to another caller. Sam, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, it's good that I'm following up on this lawyer's comment or his comments. I'm questioning the copyright and patent recognition that Taiwan presently has, because for many years they just thumbed their nose at this whole idea of respecting royalties.
It's been a problem on the mainland too, of course.
But the question is where they stand today, and for the most part, I don't think it's probably changed much.
Yeah,
Shelley Rigger.
Actually, it has changed. I mean, by no means is it a perfect situation, but the U.S. government put Taiwan on the Super 301 list, which adds a lot of scrutiny and potential sanctions based on violations of copyrights, royalties, that kind of thing, intellectual property rights. And I think the Taiwanese government, since the early to mid-1990s, has been making a lot of strides on that front. And as I say, by no means, you can definitely still go to a market in southern Taiwan and find pirated DVDs and so on. But compared to how things were when, for example, the previous caller, Kenneth, was there back in the 80s when copyright violation was rampant, I think the situation has improved a lot, in part because people in Taiwan now have technology that they want to protect. And so they're a little more aware that it's a two-way street. And if you don't protect somebody else's intellectual property rights, you're not protecting your own.
Let me thank Sam for his call, and on we go to San Jose. Kevin, you're on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Presuming that we take China at their word that they will eventually politically want to reunify the two countries. And I note that China has is building an aircraft carrier and has plans for another one and is putting vast investment into their military machine. I can only ask what you feel China's long-term military strategy must be, considering that the United States has between 15 and 20 carriers in the Seventh Fleet, and how would China expect to be able to reunify Taiwan by beating the Seventh Fleet? I don't know how you would reconcile the military with the political strategies. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the call. Shelley Rigger.
At this point, I think Beijing's strategy is mainly deterrent. So they want to make sure that Taiwan doesn't lunge for formal total independence. The way I think about it is that, you know, this is if this is a marriage, then the couple has been separated for 50 years. And there was a time back in the 1990s in particular when a lot of Taiwanese people said, you know, let's just file for divorce and get it over with. And when they started to talk that way, the Chinese government made it abundantly clear that there would be dire consequences if those divorce papers got filed. And so what you see now in Taiwan is people willing to say, look, the situation that we have right now is not perfect, but it's okay. It's a whole lot better than either of the alternatives.
Let's not rock the boat at this point. Yeah.
Right. So, and that I think is actually, at least for the time being, acceptable to the PRC government. But what they're afraid of is that something will change, or that, you know, someone will make a kind of political calculation in this very vibrant democracy. And, you know, we always have to pay attention to the possibility for kind of extreme voices in a democracy to catch fire.
Or more nationalism, or
right,
politics breeding more nationalism. Here's actually a dovetailing of that. Leo sends this email. He says, thanks for a great show. I think it's fantastic to bring about more understanding about Taiwan for forum listeners. As an immigrant to the United States from Taiwan with fervent Taiwanese pride and desire for an independent Taiwan, I see that reunification is inevitable due to Beijing's power through social and economic assimilation in the next 30 to 50 years. Does your guest see a solution toward an independent, sovereign Taiwan? I would love to hear one.
Well, and that, I think, to go back to the previous question, is exactly what the PRC government is most committed to right now, is preventing that. So they don't have to have unification in the near term, although they certainly prefer it in the medium to long term. But they have to make sure that Taiwan doesn't lunge for independence. So that's what a lot of their military preparation is about complicating U.S. involvement and also making it much harder for Taiwan to defend itself so that they can kind of soften up the situation. And if they felt the need to act militarily to prevent Taiwan independence, they want to have the ability to succeed at that. But actually compelling unification, at least in the near term, I think is really something that the PRC leadership understands is too costly. So that leaves Taiwanese in a difficult spot, because many Taiwanese people, like Leo, they want to finalize this divorce. They just want to get on with their lives. And they really can't, because they are under a military threat that has taken on an economic dimension. What would happen to Taiwan's economy if they were to suddenly say, you know, we've had it with this China thing, we can't stand the waiting any longer,
and
we're
then
just
China might
go
just
for
cut
it.
Them off in terms of exports and so forth.
Right. And this would be very bad for China, too, because, you know, there's a lot of Taiwanese investment money in the PRC economy. But a lot of those investors would probably keep doing what they're doing. You know, it would definitely hurt Taiwan more. So, you know, the Taiwanese are in a dilemma. They can't have necessarily the best case outcome, and they're trying to avoid the worst case outcome.
Again, if you'd like to contribute to this conversation, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Yi Kwan is joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, I am a Taiwanese who has lived in Berkeley for over 40 years. And I would really, really like to thank you and especially Professor Rieger for putting on such a show. I think it's very important for American people and especially politicians in this country to truly understand the issues surrounding Taiwan. They have great importance to the United States, geopolitically, economically as well. And I think Professor Rieger's points are very factually based, accurate, and politically balanced. I would just like to add one comment. When China talks about reunification, according to historical fact, it's not really reunification. It should be called annexation of Taiwan by China. And that is tremendously important thing for the U.S. to understand. And let me just cap with one anecdote, recent anecdote, about the young democracy of Taiwan. As we know, that Taiwan is into a very important election.
You have an election in January in Taiwan, coming up in January. Yeah.
And the Democratic Progressive Party is trying to regain power, the government in Taiwan, because currently Taiwan government is run by the Chinese Nationalist Party, KMT, which came back to power in 2008. And that government, is very, very misleading about the hopes and wish of people of Taiwan. 80% of people in Taiwan are opposed to what's called reunification with China. So it's very important for the U.S. to support, work with people of Taiwan in order to put the course of development of democracy in Taiwan on a sound ground. And this kind of steadfast relationship with the people of Taiwan and the progressive forces of Taiwan is very important to the United States.
All right, Iquan, I thank you for your call. Shelley Rieger, do you want to respond?
We can take another call if you want to.
Then let's do that. Okay. Timothy is our next caller. Timothy, join us.
Yes, Ms. Rieger, in your book, I wondered if you take a retrospective looking at the current situation and then a prospective, what does the future hold for Taiwan? When you think you were stating that Taiwan has received an enormous amount of military and economic aid, I don't believe the situation is quite that. When you look at Israel in 1968, I believe the after the Six-Day War, we zoomed up in our military and economic support of Israel in so many different ways, and yet at the same time, we yanked military support from Taiwan. Taiwan basically has pretty much had to be on its own, watching out for itself in that dangerous part of the world. Your opinion of the rivalry, almost the competition between Israel and Taiwan for the favor of the United States.
You make a good point that the U.S. has not given Taiwan military assistance for a long time, right? That ended when the U.S. normalized relations with the PRC in 1979, and we abrogated our mutual defense treaty with Taiwan and so on.
In fact, forgive me, I'm looking at an email here from a listener in San Jose who says, if the U.S. really cares about Taiwan, why did the U.S. abandon Taiwan in 1979?
Yeah, the U.S., it's a very interesting history. There's a wonderful book called Straight Talk by Nancy Bernkoff Tucker, a historian of U.S.-China Taiwan relations. And she mined the archives of the Nixon and Kissinger visits to China in 1971 and 72. And it's very clear that Nixon and Kissinger told Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai that they were going to get Taiwan. It was no problem. And led the PRC leadership to believe that this was something that would kind of solve itself. Fast forward to 79, when President Carter is negotiating normalization of relations with the PRC and realizes that there's no way politically within the U.S. that Taiwan can be kind of decisively abandoned in the way that the PRC leaders might have been anticipating or hoping. So we've had kind of a problematic relationship with both sides ever since then, because neither side really got what they were expecting. That is to say, neither Taipei nor Beijing got what they were expecting. Both felt like they had had broken promises from the U.S. So one of the complications of U.S. policy ever since is trying to manage the expectations of these two sides. But it's certainly true that the U.S. When the U.S. sells weapons to Taiwan, Taiwan pays. You know, this isn't military giveaways. This is military sales.
And we thank the caller, and we go to another call. And that's you, Michelle. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I just have a couple comments. I'm actually from mainland China, and I feel a pity that, you know, people from mainland China are usually shy and, you know, moderate and less aggressive to make comment publicly, and I think that's probably not to our interest. And I just want to say I'm very offended by the way your guest addressed Taiwan as a country. I mean, compared to the way this is sort of a still controversial. In the world, and just imagine if you were to call Palestine as a country out loud. It's just doesn't seem right in this country particularly, and to our mainland China, this is just doesn't seem that right. There's a lot of issues needs to resolve between us, mainland China, and Taiwan. And I think the involvement of U.S. just making things very, very complicated.
Let me get Professor Rigger's response to just the idea that Taiwan shouldn't be called a country.
Well, you know, some Americans really turn themselves inside out trying to think of a better way to talk about it. You know, is it an entity? Is it a... we language fails us. And I actually say in the book that the fact that I've just referred to Taiwan as a country will cause some readers to drop this book in horror, because yes, it is true that the PRC's official position is that there is no government, there is no state, there is no political entity in Taiwan. But I have to live in the world as it is. And when I enter Taiwan, my passport gets checked by someone. And, you know, if I drive my car on the wrong side of the road, I'm issued a ticket by someone. And I go to observe elections there where they're electing someone. And I've just kind of given up trying to satisfy everyone and use language very loosely, call Taiwan a country. Sometimes I slip up and even call it a nation because... At some point, you know, we have to use the language we have. And we don't have a word for what Taiwan is in this world because it's the only one.
Let me thank the caller. And here's Bruce who says, I think the history of Taiwan should be clarified. It was Japan who helped develop Eastern nations' democracy with people like Sun Yat-sen motivated by the fear of encroaching Western imperialism.
Yes, the Japanese era was extremely important in Taiwan's development. The first elections in Taiwan, which were very, very limited in terms of the franchise, but the first elections in Taiwan were conducted under the Japanese colonial government, and they were continued pretty seamlessly over into the nationalist era. And I've argued in another book that Taiwan's democratization owes a lot to the fact that it had elections from the 1920s on.
And here's Robin joining us from Fremont. Robin, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thanks, Michael. So I have two comments. By the way, there are a lot of comments, like I say, but I don't have that much time. So first thing is that there are a lot of nuances regarding the history of how China and Taiwan have become separated, and I think little parts of these histories are all important. But I don't know if the average American listener out there understands that. The Taiwan refers to itself officially still as the Republic of China, and according to its constitution, it's still sovereign over the entire territory of the country of China. And my second comment is that when the practical problems of the Taiwan becoming independent is that the average Chinese citizen is not going to be for it, and any Chinese government in Beijing that permits that is itself not going to continue. So that's one of the practical problems that Taiwan has.
All right. I thank you for that comment. Actually, here's a web comment that I can't resist. It says, to take the divorce topic further, it's that China has divorced Taiwan but still wants to sleep with it. China's claiming Taiwan is part of its land because most of the Taiwanese come from China. So I guess China should claim Singapore, Malaysia, or Monterey Park in California. I think the key is the United States' stand on Taiwan's political situation. Without U.S. support, there is nothing Taiwanese can do politically. Taiwan has no seat in the United Nations, not a member of most international organizations, needs your support. Actually, only diplomatic relations with some 24 countries right now. And in fact, getting a lot of emails to talk about the United Nations. In fact, let me just read one. Deborah from Saratoga says, if my facts are wrong, please correct me. It is my recollection that until around 1972, the UN recognized only Taiwan. Then suddenly the UN changed and recognized PRC, now known as China, and Taiwan lost its membership in the UN. It didn't make sense to me then for the UN to first pretend the PRC didn't exist, and it doesn't make sense to me today for the UN to now pretend that Taiwan doesn't exist. Taiwan exists and should be recognized. The UN shouldn't deny Taiwan membership in order to kiss up to the PRC.
Well, and there's where some of these subtleties of history come in, right? There was some conversation in the U.S. government, actually, back in the early 70s. Is there some way we can recognize both sides? And it was Taiwan that said, no, we won't accept dual recognition. We are the Republic of China. That's it.
Well, to carry the metaphor further, it's like when a couple splits up with a divorce. It's hard to maintain a friendship for
that's right.
With both of them. Thank you, Shelley Rigger. Good to have you on here. Shelley
My
Rigger's
pleasure.
Book again is Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island Global Powerhouse. She'll be at the World Affairs Council tonight at 6 p.m. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, another hour ahead. Adam Gopnik joining us in the hour ahead. Talk about food and other things related to the culinary. Thanks for being a part of this hour. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.